Hello and welcome to this podcast produced by the Northern Region of the University and College Union. My name's John Bryan, and in this episode, we're releasing it on Wednesday, the 27th of January, 2021, which is Holocaust Memorial Day. Now, you may well know that the 27th of January has been designated a day where we remember the Holocaust. And in this episode of the podcast, we are talking to Marek Szlabecki, who is a UCU representative, as well as someone who has researched his own family history and the way in which they witnessed what happened in the Holocaust, as well as their experiences in Poland before and during the war. Okay, I'm joined by Marek Szlabecki, who is an associate professor in physics at Durham University. And Marek is also the vice president of the University and College Union, UCU, at Durham University, which is how I met him more than 10 years ago now. Thanks very much for joining us, Marek.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And back in, although I've known you for more than 10 years, it wasn't till sort of March 2018 at one of the teach-outs, which was taking place during the USS dispute. And it was actually on the day in which the no capitulation hashtag was trending on Twitter for people who remember that particular time. And you were doing a talk, but it was more of a sing-song of Polish songs of protest and resistance. And I think one of the things that you did is you tested our singing ability as well as our Polish ability. And it was after that I got talking to you about your family history and the research that you did through the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. And I notice on that you say, I'm not a Holocaust survivor. You say you're not Jewish or even the son of a Holocaust survivor. And you say, I'm the son of a Holocaust witness. So could you talk to us about that and why you think it's still important to tell the stories that you have researched?
Yeah, thank you very much, John, and well done with the name. So as you've just said, I always start these talks. I also include one other thing I'm not. I'm not a historian. I'm a scientist. So this is very much an amateur attempt at trying to pull history together. But we generally live very comfortable, safe, privileged lives. But also we live in difficult times. We've experienced some hardships over the last year with the coronavirus pandemic. But we live in times when it appears that hatred is on the rise. And once all the witnesses to the Holocaust are gone, it's our duty, the people who are in some way connected to it, to speak for them. As Primo Levi said in his book, If This Is a Man, he said, I do not comprehend, I cannot tolerate that a man be judged not for what he is, but for the group into which he happens to belong. Many people, many nations can find themselves holding more or less wittingly that every stranger is an enemy. And it's essentially it's the othering of people. It's the horrendous sort of it's the maximum, in a way, the sort of the genocide that was experienced during the Holocaust, example of that. There are others, of course, but this is the one to which I am connected. You know, here people were erased. They were killed, they were exterminated, they were burnt in they were killed in gas chambers and burnt in crematoria. The whole existence was wiped out. But not only that, their names were erased. The records of their births, of their lives, disappeared. It's as if they never existed. And that, of course, was the whole point. It was to erase not only the people, but their culture and history from the face of the earth. If you go into the museum at the former Nazi German concentration camp at Auschwitz, which is near the town of Oświęcim in Poland, you'll find another quote from Primo Levi, and it says, "It happened, therefore it can happen again." This is the core of what we have to say. It can happen, and it can happen everywhere. And I'm sure we're all aware of places, some far, some near to where we are now, where the very germs of such hatred can start. And I would also just draw you back to another event that happened in that place. The last year was the 75th anniversary on the Holocaust Memorial Day of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau camp. And there was a talk given at the ceremony which took place there just before the pandemic started raging over us. And there was a Holocaust survivor called Marian Turski, who gave a speech at that event. And it's worth looking up. His name is spelled Turski. And he gave an account of how this all started. And it starts in a very innocuous way with a sign appearing on a bench in the 1930s in a district of Berlin that said, "No Jews here." And how for that very first thing, you might think, well, okay, I won't sit there. That's no big deal. But from that, it builds up in steps until you get to the ultimate Holocaust. So the small beginnings are the things to be frightened of, in fact. So my family originates in Poland. Both my parents are from Warsaw. And both my parents died in 2008. But many of the conversations I had with my father over many years always came back to the time when he was in his early 20s, when Poland was occupied by Nazi Germany. He was 17 the day after the invasion in 1939. And by 1944, he was 22 years old when he took part in the Warsaw Uprising of 1944, where essentially the city was completely destroyed and about 250,000 people were killed. And he never went back to Poland until 1989, when the regime there changed. But his conversations always came back to this episode of history, and he had quite a tumultuous existence there. So I have a photograph of my dad and a friend of his from school on a bike, actually on the street that they live. And I can place that photograph almost precisely to somewhere between the 23rd of November 1939 to October 1940. And the reason for that is, if you look at the background of the photograph, in the front you see two lads on their bikes. And in the background you see some men walking down the street. And if you look very closely at one of them, you'll see that he's wearing an armband on his arm. And that's the Star of David armband that the Jewish population of Warsaw was, and in fact of all occupied territories, was forced to wear. And the reason he was there is that the borders of the ghetto had not yet been defined. So there was no or less restriction about moving there. But after October 40, that's when the wall went up. And I'll begin to tell this story. I was always fascinated by the events of what happened in this time. And I had the opportunity to apply to the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust to do a piece of research in Warsaw, to research my family's history during the occupation, so I could do exactly the sort of thing I'm doing today and talk about it to emphasize what happened. And I'm really grateful to them for providing me with the funding and the university for providing me with the time to go and do this. I spent 3 months in Warsaw going to museums and archives and talking to family members and other friends of family members to try and piece together what actually happened. So I'll tell you the story from the beginning. I have to go back a little bit into Polish history just to say that before the First World War, Poland was occupied, was split into three by the imperial powers of Prussia, Russia, and Austro-Hungary. And Warsaw itself found itself in the Russian sector, as it were, of the country. And that situation lasted from about 1792 to 1918. So what we call in Britain Remembrance Day, the 11th of November, is actually Polish Independence Day, because that's the day the state came back into existence. So my grandfather was an apprentice printer in a factory that made wallpaper, and he was an apprentice printer there. He was also a trade unionist. He was also a troublemaker. He was arrested several times by the Tsarist police for organizing strikes and taking part in protests, notably one in 1904, which took place in the Grzybowski Square, which was against Polish men being conscripted to the Russian army to fight in the Russo-Japanese War. I tried to find out a little bit more about him. He was also a member of the Polish Socialist Party, the revolutionary faction, which was came out of an organization called Proletariat, which was the very beginnings of the sort of socialist movement in that time in Poland. But this was the faction which wanted, above all, to have independence for Poland, free from the diktats of the occupying powers. So I found out that in 1910 or thereabouts, he was married to somebody from the Ukraine, and they had a daughter called Eugenia. And I managed to get the marriage certificate, and from that I could work out that actually his wife, called Stefanida, was actually pregnant at the time they were married. And the marriage took place in a Russian Orthodox church in Wola, in the Wola district of Warsaw, where they lived. Very shortly after that, when World War I started, he was actually conscripted into the Russian army and fought at the Battle of Tannenberg, and was taken prisoner by the Prussians and taken to a prisoner of war camp in Lambsdorff, in a place now called Wambinowice, which is in Poland now. And in 1918, just as things began to crumble, the war was ending, he managed to escape. And he took part in the Polish Poznań, the Greater Polish Poznań Uprising of December 1918, and also in the Silesian Uprising, and managed to return back to Warsaw in 1919. And at that point, he discovered that his wife and his daughter had disappeared. They had left, probably to go back to the Ukraine, where she came from. Being Russian or Ukrainian in Warsaw at that time was clearly not very popular after having been occupied by those nations, and she may have felt safer returning back home. So he filed for divorce, which he got in 1919, and he, from being a trouble causer and a troublemaker, he actually became a police officer in the newly founded Polish National Police Force. He started off at the bottom, and eventually he worked his way up to being a detective. He then married my grandmother in 1922, and my dad was born in 1922. Sorry, he married her shortly before that. She was called Maria, and my dad had a sister was born in 1928, when my dad was six. But unfortunately, his mother, my grandmother. Got an infection in the hospital where the child was born, and both she and the child was born shortly afterwards. My dad was brought up by his father and by his father's mother, so his grandmother. And in 1935, he married again, and this time he married a lady called Anna Wachtel, and Anna Wachtel was Jewish. They had another daughter, who was my dad's half-sister. And in the 1930s, by looking at his sort of the job applications he put in and the CVs that he wrote, you could see that he left the police force. And he gave various reasons for leaving the police force in the mid-1930s. One was that his wife was Jewish. There was a rise in anti-Semitism at the time. Another was that his left-wing politics was no longer desired in the police force. He also was definitely involved in uncovering some corruption in the police force at quite a high level. So he left the police force and then ended up, my dad was always very surprised. He was working in a Skoda factory on the outskirts of town as a storekeeper, which he, my dad never understood why he went from such a good job to doing that. But it transpires that he was also, in a way, either for some organization or of the state or for the Skoda itself, he was actually working undercover and discovered some corruption in the factory there where the directors were stealing good cables. They were building aeroplane engines and cables for telecoms in that factory. And the directors were basically taking good cables, marking them as scrap and reaping the profits. And he uncovered this. And shortly after that, the Polish state nationalized that factory because clearly it would be vital to sort of the war effort. So I'm not really sure what happened there or how that ended up, but he could have, there were many reasons why he ended up there. But at that time, Warsaw was a city of about 1.3 million people, and a third of that were Jewish. Now, when I say a third of the population were Jewish, that's a very large percentage. There were some people who were very assimilated, very non-religious Jews, but there were also Orthodox Jewish communities. And so all through society at different levels, you would find the Jewish community represented. There were some Jewish members of parliament, obviously various jobs that they did, much commerce, etc. But there were also very poor Jewish families who lived in very bad circumstances, just as there were very poor slums where Poles also lived. So the situation was the Polish politics at the time was very difficult, and it was becoming more reactionary as time went on. In 1939, Poland was invaded by Nazi Germany. And at that point, all schools were closed. Culture was dumbed down hugely in terms of, theatres were eventually only allowed to produce very sort of bawdy and bass material. Listening to the music of Chopin was banned. Having a radio in your house was banned. The press was banned, apart from pro-Nazi papers. Trams used to go around with signs on them saying "Nur für Deutsche," so only Germans allowed in this part of the tram. So it was a sort of apartheid was coming in here, and at that point, everybody was tainted with the, if you met a Nazi walking down the, in uniform, walking around the street, Poles and Jews and everybody were supposed to walk in the gutter and bow down to them to show you who was the great masters around here. And that's how it started, and it got worse and worse. So my father was not, at first, he was not allowed to go to school. He was just about to finish his schooling. But he wasn't allowed to go to school. But as everybody who's experiencing lockdown knows, it's very difficult to keep 17-year-olds in the house all the time. And he wanted to be off with his mates and get up to stuff. And he eventually joined the resistance. In fact, he was so secretive, he joined twice, because when he was approached the second time, he didn't want to admit that he was already had taken the oath and had joined the resistance beforehand. But resistance started almost the day that the Nazis invaded, or at least the day that Warsaw capitulated. And that also is true of Jewish resistance. One of the Jewish combat organizations was already beginning to organize in 1939. My dad joined up. He was the resistance. He joined the Home Army, the Armia Krajowa. There were a number of different resistance groups. And he started off by distributing leaflets and developing photographs. He was a very keen amateur photographer. And he'd been actually trained by a Jewish portrait photographer who he had befriended years beforehand, who had shown him how to do these things. So he would get films, he would develop them and pass them on. And he had the code name Siegfried. So everybody had a code name. So Siegfried or Siegfried was his. So nobody would be able to tell us who else was connected to whom. So when the ghetto was being formed, when the repressions against the Jews became stronger. They were not allowed to have work, have bank accounts, go to school, pray in synagogues, etc., etc. So they were basically had no way of making a living and no way really of existing. The ghetto was about to be formed, but in order to form a ghetto, you had to move the Poles out who were living in the houses where the ghetto was going to be. So my grandfather swapped houses with a Jewish doctor, a ear, nose and throat specialist, and they swapped houses. It was a friend of his, and the deal was that they would swap houses back when the war finished. His name was Dr. Weinkipper, and he survived, actually. It's important to know that, but of course both houses were completely destroyed in the war. So the ghetto eventually housed 400,000 people in about 1.3 square kilometres. That's something about the size of the central part of Durham City. It's quite tiny, but there were, 30, 40 people living in single rooms in some places. My father, at that point, they were living on the edge of the ghetto, but outside the wall. He got a job as a trainee toolmaker in the Januszkiewicz specialist metalwork factory, which was a factory that made medical supplies. They made kitted out operating theatres and made beds for hospitals, etc. And he was a trainee toolmaker there. And he also had an education at that time. He would go on a special course because technical education was allowed up to a certain level. But the factory was actually in the ghetto. So every day he had a permit and he would be able to cross into the ghetto, go to work and come back out at the end of the day. The ghetto was surrounded by a wall. The wall sometimes it cut across tram tracks, it cut through gardens, it cut through buildings in places. The factory that my dad worked in was on Trzybowska Street, which was the same street where he used to live beforehand. It's very near the Westin Hotel if you ever go to Warsaw now. But there were cracks in this system. People used to smuggle goods in and bring money in, goods out, so that the people in the ghetto did manage to eke out some sort of an existence, at least at the beginning. The Jewish officers for the Jewish council, or the Judenrat, as the Nazis called it, were on Trzybowska Street opposite the factory. And the leader of the Judenrat, the Jewish council, was a man called Adam Czerniakow, who was a former Polish senator who had been appointed to that role by the mayor of Warsaw just before the city capitulated. And he was the person who tried to negotiate as much as he could with the Nazis to keep he was like the mayor of that region, trying to keep the thing going in terms of sanitation and food and health, etc. This was a very difficult job that he had. My dad had a stroke in 2005, and I went down to, just before he had the stroke, I went down to help him sort his paperwork out. And he had a little safe where he kept lots of bits and pieces. And I was clearing this safe to make sure everything was in order. And I found an old brown wallet in that safe. And I said to him, "What's this, Dad?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "that was a wallet that was given to me by a Mrs. Mick or Pick in thanks for helping her out in the ghetto." And he told me the story that he had promised his father that he wouldn't be involved in taking goods out, but he would take money in. So when he went into the ghetto, he could take money in and deliver it to people who'd sold things outside the ghetto. And there was a dispute about some goods, and he had actually even been a witness to show this that this lady hadn't been responsible for some sort of misunderstanding. And he was given this wallet, which he kept to this day, and I have, and it's just an old battered wallet, but it's the history of where it's come from is extremely moving. I'll tell you a few stories from the time when my dad was going in and out of the ghetto. So at this time, obviously, they've moved out of the ghetto, but my step-grandmother and his half-sister at that point were no longer living with the father and with my dad. They'd moved out somewhere. My dad was not 100% sure where they'd lived, where they were at the time, because they obviously, the Nazis would be looking for them. And this is really a key part of my research is about what happened in this story. But these are a few things my dad recorded for me, episodes that happened. So his stepmother's sister was called Vanda, and she was in the ghetto along with her brother. They managed to bribe one of the ghetto guards to allow her to walk out through the gate at one point. And my dad was there to meet her, take her out, and she bottled it. She was too frightened to come out, and they never saw her again. And we think that she ended up along with her brother in Treblinka, in the extermination camp. On another occasion, my father was walking to work down the street, and as there was no petrol at the time, at least certainly not available to Jews in the ghetto, there was a hand cart, like a rickshaw, that was being pushed by a Jewish man. And as he was pushing this rickshaw down the street, it scraped down the side of a Gestapo car, which stopped in the street. And one of the officers in the car got out. Gunpoint made everybody who was in the street at the time stop and watch what happened. And the other one took a bullwhip out of the car and whipped the man to death in the street, to death. It was just an absolutely horrific scene. And my father was forced to watch this, as was everybody else around. On another occasion, he was at home and he had a stack of leaflets for distribution in the house. And his father obviously also knew about this. And his father was out and he'd fallen asleep on the sofa when there was a knock on the door. He answered the door and it was the Gestapo along with a Polish-speaking policeman who came into the house, into the flat, put my father up against the wall with a gun to the back of his head. And he said this was such an intense experience. He could see the individual brush strokes of the paint on the wall. It was like it was so intense. And they said to him, where's your stepmother, the Jewish bitch? Where is she? Tell us. My father was quite a quick thinker. And he said at this point, I don't know. I hate her. If I knew where she was, I'd tell you. She used to beat me. I would be the first to tell you. And he was so convincing in what he said that they believed him and they let him go. Of course, none of it was true. His stepmother was extremely kind to him and he loved her very much, but he thought quickly and managed to save that situation. And of course he didn't also take the leaflets, which would have condemned him as well at that point. Probably one of the most amazing there was another situation where my grandfather would take Jews who would either come from other parts of Poland or from the ghetto, and he would put them up at his house and then pass them on to some other part of the resistance who would then take people out or pass them on to somebody else. And there were two instances my father relayed to me. Once when there was a young woman came to stay with them, she was desperate to go outside and go to a cafe because she had been cooped up in houses, being put from one place to another. And my father took her out, and he was about, I think, 19 at the time, and he said he got such a bollocking from his dad for doing that because it put him and everything at such risk for having done that. Another situation was when they had a guy who was a pharmacist staying. My father was never sure who these people were, but in the middle of the night, the Nazis came and they took everybody out from that block of flats, and they made all the men drop their trousers to see whether they'd been circumcised or not. And luckily, in that particular situation, the pharmacist was not Jewish but was involved in some other resistance work, and he was left alone because they didn't work out who he was. So these things were just as a matter of course. People would be rounded up on the streets. People would be shot on the streets. They were so-called wapanki, or catching anybody in the population, simply to show that resistance doesn't pay, and if there are recriminations for everything. But there's one incident I'd like to really relate to you, and that's on the 22nd of June, 1942, when my father had a letter to give to the leader of the Jewish Council, to Adam Chernyakov, in the Jewish Council offices just across the road from his factory. And he had a note hidden in a bread roll. And he'd been across and taken a message to Adam Chernyakov before. My grandfather also knew Adam Chernyakov because my dad said, you remember that he asked him, how's your dad doing? On the first time he went, he had a message hidden in his tie at that time. This time it was in a bread roll. He went across the road and he saw the receptionist in the bottom of the council office. And before he could do anything else, he heard the screeching of tires outside and the pounding of boots as dozens of armed soldiers and Gestapo SS came in. He was absolutely frightened to the core here at this point. And the young lady who was the receptionist there gave him and managed to pass to him a Jewish armband, a Star of David armband, which he put on. Because if he'd have been in that place and found in that place, he would also have been probably executed. Because helping a Jew in any way in Poland at that time was an offence in the eyes of the Nazis, which was punishable by death, not only for you, but your whole family. He was given this Star of David armband and he was given a mop and he managed to go into the toilets and pretended he was mopping the floor and that he worked there. But he said upstairs where the council officers were, he could hear furniture being thrown about, people being hit and screams and etc. And what was happening here is that the Nazis were persuading Adam Chernyakov to sign a decree to tell the Jewish population of the ghetto that several thousand people had to assemble at the Umschlagplatz the next day for deportation to the east. Now, at that time, deportation to the east could have been interpreted as being sent to a new homeland in the east, which is why the Nazis tried to sell it. But of course, where they were actually going to Treblinka to be exterminated. And Chernyakov was resisting. He was refusing to put his name to that order. He tried to save the children. He tried to save all orphans and workers. He tried to negotiate. And at one point, they even kidnapped his wife and held her hostage to try and make him sign that order. But that very night, I think it was, or the night afterwards, Adam Chernyakov committed suicide. And in his suicide note, he wrote, "One day my people will understand what I have done." And the order was issued without his signature on it the next day. But while this beating was going on upstairs, my father was downstairs mopping the floors. And when the troops left, he passed the note over very quickly and legged it back to the factory. And his friends in the factory where he was working were absolutely... So they said he was as white as a sheet and had, he'd had the fright of his life again, and he'd been gone for quite a while, more than he should have been. So I then tried to find out what had happened to my dad's stepmother and her daughter, my dad's half-sister. So I went to the Holocaust. I went to the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw. And I found the cards which had been filled in by all the Holocaust survivors. And that included my step-grandmother and my aunt, my dad's half-sister. And in the forms that they filled in 1945, after the war was over, it said that they'd lived in a place owned by Mrs. Gajewska, and the house was called Carmen Sita, which is an unusual name for a house in Poland. And it also said, "What names did you use during the occupation?" And the name that my step-grandmother, whose name was Anna, gave was Eugenia Szablewska. What my grandfather had done, it's a very clever thing. He got his first daughter from his first marriage in 1910, took her birth certificate from the Russian Orthodox Church, so she was a Christian. And his wife became his daughter. The age gap difference was small enough to pull it off. And of course, if she was challenged, she had Aryan papers, as it were. And so they couldn't prove that she was Jewish. even though they knew she existed, they couldn't prove that it was her. So they were living in a place called Carmen Sita. So I tried to find out where this was. And I found the road and I found the town. It's called Leshna Podkova, which is a sort of, a garden town outside of Warsaw. So it's built very much in woodland. It was built in the 1930s. And I found the road, but I couldn't find the house. And so I consulted a local historian who told me about it. He said, yes, Carmen Sita. He said, that's where the terrible things happened. And my dad knew that something awful had happened, but he was never really sure what. And this is the story of what happened. So Carmen Sita was ostensibly run by a lady called Carmen Aharmainska. And she had a Jewish Russian father and a Spanish mother, hence the Carmen Sita name. And when the Nazi occupation came, she took on the name of Gajewska to make it sound as if she wasn't Jewish. And it was a guest house, so people would come and stay there. And this is the place where my step-grandmother and and her daughter were living during the occupation. And this was frequented by lots of Nazis, this guest house. They would come and eat there and drink there. And they had probably quite a lot of Jews under their noses and not knowing who they were. But at some point in 1944, probably about June, the guest house was visited by a couple of SS officers who told Mrs. Aharmainska, or Gajewska, as she called herself, that they wanted food, and she gave them food, and they then wanted drink, she gave them drink. And at that point, she realized that this was possibly going to be very dangerous, and she gave word for everybody in the house to leave, and they did, all bar one person who remained upstairs, who basically recorded and wrote up what happened. At some time in the night, when they were drinking with her, one of these officers said to her, "You're Jewish." And she denied it. She said, "No, I'm not. I'm not Jewish. I was born in Odessa." And they said, "Where are your papers?" She said, "I haven't got any papers. But there are people in Warsaw who can vouch for me." They got her. They said, "Right, get in the car." And they put her in the car, and they were driving on the road to Warsaw. But at some point, not far from where they started, the car stopped. And they took her out and shot her in the back of the head and dumped her in the ditch by the side of the road. And her body was discovered in the morning by the gardener of the house that was next to the road. And it was actually the house that belonged to quite a famous writer called Ivashkevich. And this is also recorded. And the German authorities at that point said that this woman must not be buried. She must be left to rot like a dog at the side of the road as a punishment so that people know what happens to those who help Jews. But people did come, and people did put stones over her and ultimately buried her and put flowers by where she was buried. So she gave her life and saved a lot of people. So I say the name Carmen Aharmainska. Nobody will ever hear that name again. But that woman is responsible for saving many lives.
I mean, that's quite, obviously, it's a very shocking story. And, you know, I remember reading it in the research that you've done. And I think what really kind of gripped me about the research was these stories that you've managed to kind of bring to life involving your family and that your family knew. And the difficulties, yeah. I mean, one of the other things that came across was the difficulties of trying to kind of exactly find out what happened, because there was this kind of deception that had to take place where people denied certain things or people changed identity. And I mean, I think you've talked about that, you know, quite a lot, and it's mentioned in the research as well. And I think I know you talk in your research about the complexity of survival during tumultuous times, and the examples that you've given and the stories that you've told bring that across quite vividly, really, you know, in a way that, they are stories that need to continue to be told, as you said right at the start of this. And I know you've spoken at Durham Cathedral, you've spoken at Durham University, you've spoken at schools. What are the sorts of kind of central messages that you try and get across? Because obviously sometimes it'll be different audiences that you're speaking to.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think the one I'll never forget actually is one I gave at the cathedral where there was school kids from all over County Durham, and I was the main speaker that day because I think the speaker who was actually a Holocaust survivor was unable to come through illness, so they pulled me in to be the main speaker, and they allowed the kids to ask questions. And the questions were absolutely brilliant. I don't know if you remember, there was an incident a few years ago where there were asylum seekers in Middlesbrough, and the council had painted all their doors a particular colour so anybody could identify who they were.
I recall.
I think that was the story.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Does that ring a bell? And one of the kids related that tale, that sort of, it was current in the news then, to the situation here about how you identify people as being other. And I think that the key thing here is, you know, these are all people. It doesn't matter what they are, what they believe in, how they look, what language they speak. They're people. And, you know, this need to make people different so that you can say we're better than you or you're worse than we are. That's the root beginning of the cause, and it's about working against that you know, that sort of thinking. I always finish my talks with I show a movie that's from the Warsaw Uprising Museum, and it shows a sort of a simulated flight in 1945 over the city of Warsaw in the ruins. I mean, the city was actually you know, it was more damaged in terms of buildings demolished by the time the Warsaw Uprising, so the Jewish uprising in the ghetto, the extermination of the ghetto, the Warsaw Uprising itself, and then the city was sacked by the Nazis, who stole priceless objects and destroyed any sort of cultural landmarks that were still standing. I show this simulated flight over the city. And I say, you know, you've seen where it begins and this is where it ends. It ends in complete destruction. And that's what hatred gives you. That's not what love of your fellow people gives you. That's what othering and superiority brings you. And it's just dangerous. And I want people to imagine that some of the things that I talk about didn't happen in fiction. They happened. They were real. They happened to people who were in my family. They happened to millions of Jewish families who were wiped off the face of the earth. And imagine that happening to the people that you love, the people that you care for. Nothing is. I mean, to allow that to happen is such a shocking thing, and you have to be ever vigilant. So I that's how I usually end, and I suppose that's what I'm trying to tell you about. You know, that's what I'm trying to tell these stories. Because these things, you know, my dad used to say that civilization is only veneer thin. You know, it doesn't take much for it to go wrong. And I think we've all seen examples of that over the last few years where we think we're very civilized, we think we're very cultured, and yet some horrific things happen on our watch, as it were. And it's all of our responsibility, really, to stop this from happening. You know, so after the episodes I've described to you, in 1943, there was an uprising in the Jewish ghetto, where again, you know, over 57,000 people were killed or captured, and 36,000 of them were deported, you know, to camps, like Treblinka, where they were simply exterminated. You know, in Treblinka, in the course of just under a year, just under a million people, Jews, Roma, were executed, burnt, stripped of their possessions, and just simply exterminated, to the point that When the war finished, the Nazis basically burnt all the buildings down and furrowed the land to make it look as if nothing had been there in their place. They tried to cover it up. It's just a horrific thing. And in 1944, there was the major uprising against the Nazis, where the Polish resistance, some of the people who survived the ghetto were also there. They were very small in number, but they were there. People like Marek Edelman, who survived, one of the leaders of the ghetto uprising, was with the general uprising in 1944. That went on for 63 days. You know, just under a quarter of a million people were killed, and more destruction. So my father fought in that, and he was ready to die. He was absolutely ready to give his life at that point. He never thought he'd walk out of there alive. And he remembers in his unit, which was called Kilinski, when they were fighting, there was a young Jewish boy came to join them. And this boy was called Yusuf Martin. And he was really, really hungry. He had no food. I don't know what his story was up to that point. But my father gave him his last piece of bread that he had. And amazingly, both of them survived, and they met 50 years later when it was the 50th anniversary of the uprising, and they recognized each other and they embraced like brothers. It was a beautiful thing to see. He went off to live in the States, and my dad was in Britain. And, once they'd reconnected, they were in touch all the time because they had such a bond of what they'd been through. When the Warsaw Uprising finished, my father was taken prisoner. He was taken to Lambsdorff, to the same camp his father had been in. And then he was in a prison camp in Germany, and then eventually was liberated with the Polish forces in Italy, and ended up in Britain and became a toolmaker in Sheffield, which is where he settled. But his father and his stepmother and his half-sister were actually taken to a labor camp in Berlin, which was based in Tempelhof prison, Tempelhof airport, and they were used basically as slave labor. But my step-grandmother was still using her fake name. She would deception. So she was actually imprisoned by them, and they still didn't know who she was. And when the war was over, they were allowed back to Poland, and they tried to rebuild their lives. But of course, nothing was ever the same after that. And my father never went back until 1989, his sister's funeral. So he never saw his parents again. In fact, the last time he saw his parents was right at the end of the uprising, when there was a ceasefire. He went to the house, and they were all together at that point. And he had a massive argument with his parents because they wanted him to go out with the civilian population. And he said, I've been ready to die with my comrades, and that's where I'm going to go. And he went back. And he had tears streaming down his face. And through the rubble of the city, he was going back, and he met this completely dilapidated, emaciated Alsatian dog. And my dad loved dogs. He loved animals. And he took his pistol and he shot the dog to put it out of its misery. And it was like a symbolic end to that part of his life, because nothing would ever quite be the same again. But what we see happening around the world now, the sort of stuff goes on, in sort of the genocides we see now, history repeats itself. We seem not to learn at times that we really need to take action and to stand up for people who are victimized. My aunt went on to live in Warsaw. I did actually see her a couple of times when she was allowed to come to Britain. They would only let people out one person at a time when it was the communist Poland. But they had a son, and the son didn't know he was of Jewish heritage. My family knew, I knew, but they hadn't told him because they just feared. They feared for what the repercussions might be still even then in the 1960s, 70s and 80s. And there are many people like that in Poland who were unaware of some of their heritage, survivors essentially. So I do this to remember all those who you know, who are lost. I do it to make them, to give them an existence again, to say their names again. I do it to remind us of the need to act against hate, to act against the othering of people, and the hope that the memory serves as a reminder about things that can happen anywhere at any time. As Primo Levi said, it can happen anywhere and it can happen at any time. So that's the reasoning I do this. And I think being from a Polish family, but also with a Jewish link like that, means that I can sort of touch on both stories. You know, the horrific losses that occurred at that time. And, you know, I wish that humanity would learn from it.
Well, Marek, thanks very much for sharing your stories. I know right at the start you said that you're a amateur historian, but I've certainly enjoyed listening to you talk today and also reading the research that you've done. And just to tell people that it's easily findable on the web, if you search Surviving Warsaw, 1939 to 1945, Untold Stories of Occupation and the Ghetto, then you get Marek's research and all the detail and all the stories that Marek is trying to keep alive and to make sure that we don't forget what happened. Marek, thanks very much for coming and talking to us about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity, John. It's been a pleasure and an honour. Thank you.
We hope that you've enjoyed listening to this episode. If you have, please do tell others. And don't forget you can share our podcasts on social media. You can also follow what we do on Twitter at UCU Northern. And you can also find more details of Marek and his research that we've talked about in this episode. Please also leave us a review or like, favourite or subscribe to our podcasts so you never miss an episode. Search UCU Northern Region in any podcast provider to make sure that you always get to tune in. Thanks for listening.